What do you think the greatest gift of the holidays is? Internet? I'd say internet. Yes, absolutely. It's of course as easy as it's always been. You get an iMac, 10 minutes out of the box, you're on the internet. But now, Apple gives you your own personal website. You can post your photographs for all your family to see all over the world, and your iMovies. And now you're the purveyor of, you're the generator of, you're the author of great stuff.
Recorded live in the USA and covering the whole wide world, this is the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Chez Pazienza.
One of the things you talked about last night was the flexibility that the vice presidency has.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
That thankfully our founders were wise enough to say we have this position and it's constitutional. Vice president will be able to be not only the position flexible, but it's going to be sort of those other duties as assigned by the president. A simple thing. I don't think that was a gaffe at all.
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality. The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
That's what it's called. It's the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show. Bob Seska here. Chez Pazienza right over there. Drunken Jeff Goldblum. That's what that is from the old iMac commercial. Someone on the YouTube slowed it way down and made Jeff Goldblum sound drunk. And it's easily one of the funniest things on the internet. But I should say that you probably can't hear Chez very well.
Yeah, I sound like crap because I go ahead and announce it right now. I had not kind of expected. I'm basically in Central Florida right now taking care of my mother. You know, I mentioned last week that she had breast cancer and she underwent surgery earlier this week. So I had planned on actually sort of trading off with my dad, and my dad was going to take care of her for the end of the week. But the plans got reversed. So in other words, I'm not in Miami, which means I didn't think to bring my my microphone with me. So here I am on this piece of shit.
Yeah. So, I mean, don't adjust your speakers or anything like that. It's just a matter of circumstance. I mean, how is she doing?
She's doing okay. You know, I mean, she's in a lot of pain. I mean, obviously, she's got a big gash in her chest. And it's really, it's scary. It freaks you out. It's like, suddenly, I have this sort of vision of my mother as being a kind of superwoman that she always has in my life for a really long time. And to sort of see her laid up and it's funny because she's kind of pissed about it. And I realize now where I got my, where I get my personality from, because she's just angry. She doesn't want, not angry like in a bad way, but like just, fuck this. I don't want to deal with this. Damn it. Why do I have to go through this? And really, and not mean, it's just, I like it. I mean, once again, it just tells me where sort of I got my personality from. But she's, she's in pain now. The really good news is that while the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, operated on her, they, checked her lymph nodes and they found no cancer there. So there's a pretty good chance that they got it all. And that's what she and we are sort of hopeful about. So are hopeful for. So we'll see what happens. But, for the moment, she's doing okay, all things considered.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't even imagine something like that. From a psychological point of view alone, I mean, it's an amputation is essentially what it is.
An amputation. I believe me, I've given that a lot of thought. It's tough for me to sort of wrap my head around the idea of what it would be like to go into the hospital and basically come out with a part of you missing.
Yeah.
I'm not giving away state secrets to say that obviously she and I had a lot of conversations about it, before she went in for the surgery. And, she said flat out, she's like, look, I'm a 67-year-old woman. She says, my breasts don't have quite the meaning that they used to when I was, 25, 35, whatever. She says, so if I have to give up one of them or even both of them to make sure that I continue living, I'm okay with that. She says, and I'm not even going to really give it a second thought or spend much time stressing over it. But, yeah, I mean, you know, so far the hardest thing, obviously, for me is, you know, it's my mom. And to see her suffering has been really, really tough. And it hurts. I mean, obviously, it's a hell of a surgery. But she's kind of looking toward the future now. And you know, she's still recovering, obviously. She's going to be recovering for quite a while. And hopefully everything will work out for the best.
It's an incredible attitude. I mean, it's inspiring to hear that kind of point of view and that kind of perspective, you know, in the face of something that's kind of tragic. I mean, and irrespective of how it turns out, which it sounds like it's going to turn out for the best, that it's still, you know, again, a kind of a, you know, one of the most horrendous things you could actually experience in the course of going through life. And, you know, what always strikes me, Chaz, is that, you know, for as long as human beings have been dealing with this, and this is, of course, a bigger picture issue, I still can't believe we haven't tackled this yet. And it's frustrating. I mean, have you been going through sort of that, the stages of grief where you're going, you know, why haven't they done this? You know, what can change? What do we need to do?
First of all, I listen to a lot of Glenn Beck. So I know that they have a cure for cancer. And they just, you know, their Obama has it held in a secret vault somewhere. So, amazingly, though, Steve Jobs couldn't get it. How fucking rich do you have to be?
That's a great example. No matter how much money you have, and that guy had all the money on the planet.
Pancreatic is a freaking death sentence.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. And he was only able to buy himself an extra several years, really. And that's what all of the money, that's what Apple money buys, is just a few more years. In his case, obviously, there are different kinds of cancer and different survivability rates. But, you know, it's irrespective of where you are and what your station in life is, you have an equal opportunity to have to experience
disease.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the way I've always operated, and this is something, once again, it's moments like this that you start to realize where you got your personality from. And it's like, you know, my mom is wonderfully bitter, wonderfully like, you know, fuck this, you know, Jack Cafferty. And my father is very, very focused. My father is the ex-Navy SEAL, so, I mean, he's, you know, methodical and, okay, this is what we have to do. And more importantly than that, he cares, obviously, very, very much, but he knows that the best thing to do is sort of detach, because when you detach, you make sort of dispassionate decisions. And that's sort of what I've done. I have whatever, you know, the big gift, if you can call it that he gave to me, is my ability to kind of distance myself a little bit and just sort of focus on what needs to be done. So no, I mean, I've had a couple, when I first learned about it, I had a couple little mini breakdowns. I mean, you know, I did the whole, well, my mother, you know, and looking back on my entire life and all the amazing things she's done for me. And obviously seeing her hurting was really tough, and it's continuing. It continues to be tough, but no, from almost, you know, especially now that the surgery's happened. I mean, since the beginning when she went into the hospital, it's been, I just stay focused and do what I need to do to help her, and whatever that means, it means. So, you know, I mean, it's interesting because it's like I can tell that she's been there for me through so much, and I had a tumor pulled out of my head, for God's sake, and she took care of me. And yet it's interesting to sort of see the roles reversed, and we have this weird, like, it's creepy and scary and intimate and painful all at the same time, because it's like I obviously have to do things while taking care of her that I could never even have imagined doing. You know, I mean, she had a mastectomy, which means that I have to empty the little drain that they put on her and all these things. And I do it without even thinking. But yeah, I mean, it's just weird because it's like, well, that's my, you know, it's saying, well, that's my mom, sort of fits both ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, it's like, well, that's my mom. Of course, I'm going to do whatever it takes. I'm going to take care of her. And on the other hand, it's like, wow, well, gee, that's my mom that I'm having to, you know, that I'm actually having to do all this stuff for and make sure that she's okay. So yeah, it sits a little weird with you, but once again, I've just kind of, I detach as best I can and just do what needs to be done.
Yeah, you know, and I almost forgot, too, that you did, I don't know how I could have possibly almost forgotten this, but, I mean, you had a brain tumor. You had a, and you were operated on and the tumor removed. I mean, you wrote about it extensively. Yeah, I mean, this must all be kind of, God, I mean, how are you coping with that in terms of there being, you know, sort of sense memories and flashbacks to that experience and
I think what I went
post-traumatic stress and yeah.
I think what I went through was actually a lot easier than what she went through. You know, kind of the same thing. I mean, mine wasn't cancerous. I was very lucky. But it was still huge and bleeding and it was not pretty at all. And it was all over, you know, it was in a couple areas of my head. It had grown kind of out of control. But you know, I mean, maybe it was as bad for me as it is for her, but I guess just maybe my, you know, looking at her and sort of seeing it from the outside, what she's going through obviously seems a lot worse to me. One of the main reasons, of course, is because what they did with me didn't technically leave much in the way of scarring. With her, I mean, it's an amputation. Yeah. And it's funny because the surgery that I underwent, it changed me drastically. And I've written about this a lot. It changed so much about me, you know, hormonal output and, you know, the way my body metabolizes and stuff like that. And it changes in some ways, it changes your thought process a little bit too. It makes, you know, I mean, I was really depressed for a long time. And the funny thing is, seeing her go through this, where it's such a massive physical trauma, I do think back to the time when, you know, when right after my surgery was done and I went in for a checkup with my neurologist and he looked me in the eye and he said flat out, he goes, there is going to come a time when you will wish that we had taken your arm off because you're going to be different and you're going to know you're different. You're going to know that everything about you's changed and you're not who you used to be in so many different ways. And yet no one looking at you for the most part will be able to tell. You know, it will be almost impossible for people outside, you know, people you run into on the street to know that anything awful happened to you. And you're going to tell them, look, I'm not the same person I was, and they're not going to believe you. And that was absolutely true. I mean, I knew, and trying to explain to people, it was like trying to describe, you know, trying to make – it was like – it felt like you were going crazy. Because it's like, look, no, this is different. What's different about it? I don't know. I'm different. Everything is fucking changed. So – But yeah, I mean, she's pain-wise and everything else, though, the after effect with me, I mean, my surgery was really impressively done. I mean, which is not to knock the people at the Moffitt Cancer Center, like they didn't do a good job. They did a great job. But, you know, I went to Cornell and had, you know, a type of surgery that's done by like three places in the freaking country. And it was almost like an assembly line. And they had me in and out pretty quickly. I was out in about 4 or 5 days and – You know, I was, I don't know. I mean, four or five days. Yeah, it is pretty incredible. And I mean, the funny thing is that I actually felt worse later on. Like my immediate reaction after the surgery was actually I felt pretty good, which, you know, I've written about that extensively. I'm not going to run through it. If you want to know about it, go. I think I called it I think I titled the piece "Where Is My Mind?" That's jokingly enough. There's Pixies right. reference for you there.
Yep.
Black Francis is proud. But yeah, if you want to go look it up on DXM, it's there somewhere. But yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, well, maybe for all my detachment, I do sort of – I don't think much – I think that what I went through to me doesn't feel as bad as what I'm watching my mom go through for a whole host of reasons. But, you know, it's also not over for her and we'll see. You know, so far it looks really good, but it remains to be seen. So we'll know over the next, you know – couple of weeks, couple months, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, really quick before we get into, you know, it's a nice little segue into Steve Jobs. While I was in the hospital with my mom, I was talking to a friend of mine who probably I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the very nice listeners out there read a lot of her stuff. And I'm not going to mention her only because I don't want to give away any of her personal information. You know, she's telling me about what's going on in her life with cancer. And she actually said, and this was actually shocking to hear. She's like, I wish I could be your mom. She's like, because she has a kind of cancer that is, it's malignant, meaning it every time, like you said, every time they think they've got it, it just goes from one place to another, and it seems like they can never get hold of it and kill it.
Yeah.
And she's really, really scared, and it scares me because I love her and I think she's fantastic, and I, you know, I think I jokingly said, I'm like, look, if you really are terminal, then, you know, consider me. I'd better be on your Make-A-Wish Foundation list, like one night with me, because that would make, you know, I do what I can for you.
Yeah, I knew a guy who had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that was one of those. That's one of those types of cancers that just it nearly killed him. And he got very fortunate in that he had a kind of therapy. It was like a sort of a stem cell therapy.
Excellent.
And it got it. And he, you know, he survives today. And this must have been, you know, almost 20 years ago. So he's in good shape, thankfully. But it was, you know, it was one of those things where you thought, you know, he would, you know, practically on a daily basis, he would contact around and say, well, this might be my last message to you because I don't know, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow.
Jesus.
You know, and again, it's one of those diseases that doesn't discriminate, it's unpredictable, and they still haven't found any real, and it seems to come out like every week there seems to be some new miraculous story. Like you go to the Huffington Post and there'll be a headline that says, you know, miracle cure for cancer discovered, and it has you know, this new and advanced treatment. I think the latest one is that virus that kills all forms of breast cancer.
I did see that.
And yeah, I think we mentioned it last week. And the thing is, they haven't even started human trials on it yet. So you kind of get your hopes up and they say, well, this is going to be fantastic news. And then there's this delay. And I remember years ago, I mean, they had this other thing where they reprogrammed someone's stem cells to attack cancer cells, and they thought this was going to be a big miracle cure for cancer, and I still haven't heard anything about that yet. I mean, here's the reason. Here's why I talk about cancer a lot. I spent 16 years of my life as a smoker. I mean, I smoked a pack a day of cigarettes, and I regret it every day of my life. I regret it as much as I regret it. I am grateful that I finally had the sense to kick the habit. I mean, I went cold turkey back in 2007. And just gave it up.
Good for you.
But, you know, I did one of those crazy things where you just throw away the pack of cigarettes and you never have another one. And then I subsequently went batshit for about a month and a half. but yeah, so, I mean, I do, though. I mean, I spend a lot of time smoking, and I do worry that regardless of how healthy I am now, and I'm healthier now than I was, you know, I'm 40 years old. I'm healthier now than I was when I was 18. But regardless, I did spend all those years smoking, so I'm constantly on the lookout just for self-preservational purposes to make sure, like, well, once I get to 60, 70 years old, you know, maybe 20 years from now.
It's interesting how when you get older, you know, kind of like, I know you'll appreciate this, the Rush lyric about, you know, you're only immortal for a limited time.
Yeah.
You know, when you get older is when it starts dawning on you that all the crap that you overlooked, like all those cancer stories that you just thought, whatever, you know, suddenly it's a really big deal. And that's actually the reason why, what I was going to say, that's the reason why media outlets constantly program health stories like that, because that's who they're aiming for, people like us who are now, quite frankly, of a certain age, as the show goes. You know, who are now interested in, you know, are basically fearing for our lives. And what I was going to – what I actually wanted to say based on what you just said is the only way you're going to know for sure that some massive, massive breakthrough has happened when it comes to cancer, the easiest way to tell, having worked in TV for a long time, is if you see it like as a lead, you'll know when something huge has happened when it comes to cancer, when it's not in like the fifth medical block. You know, hey, impressive new word about cancer today. No. If they actually found something that was just freaking monumental when it came to curing cancer, or really any disease for that matter, that would be the lead. So unless you see that, you know pretty damn well that there's a catch. Yeah, look, this shows some hope, but there are no guarantees yet.
I think there was a stand-up comedian, I forget who it was specifically, so forgive me for not crediting this to the correct person, but he once said that, you know, he's at that age where if he finds something on the right side of his body, he's trying to look for it on the right side, the other side of his body as well. Oh, there's a weird thing on this side. If it's on the other side, everything's okay. But if it's not, right, I got to start freaking out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of reached that age myself where I kind of say, well, this feels a little swollen over here. I'm going to check on the opposite side and see if it's swollen there too. You know, and it's funny how that, you know, that uncertainty just kind of dominates your mindset in the darkest hours of the night. And you wake up in the middle of the night and you go, oh, that feels weird. Or, you know, but once you've confronted it and survived it, I imagine, and I know yours wasn't malignant, but, and you said your personality changed based on the surgery, but it had to have also changed based on the survivability of it. Was there a sense of gratitude that arose? That's like fate has dealt me a second hand, or, you know, a second chance in life?
I am bulletproof. Even God can't kill me. Yeah, it's funny because I spent most of my 20s thinking that. I'd look in the mirror after doing, like, you know, 10 hits of ecstasy and dare myself to die. No, yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, it did. It changed me. I mean, it made me certainly more appreciative of things. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yes and no. You know, I have an ex who would probably complain that I didn't change enough. I don't know. I really don't. I honestly don't know the correct way to answer that question. I'm sure it did. And I know, like I said, I know that just the physical aspect of what happened did sort of adjust me a little bit. And I know it adjusted me in the time leading up to getting this thing extracted from me. You know, they warned me about that ahead of time. They're like, you know, like, if you've had any mood swings lately, that's, you know, over the past few years, that's probably why. Like, oh, okay. Well, I've always had mood swings, but yeah, they've definitely been more pronounced. But yeah, I mean, look, I made it. I'm lucky. My job right now is to try to make sure my mom gets through it as best I can. So it's too late for Steve Jobs, but, you know.
Yeah.
But my mom also didn't create an iPod, so.
That's right. Well, speaking of Steve Jobs, I guess now is as good a time as any to mention Steve Jobs, because, I mean, really, the guy is easily one of the greatest innovators of our time. I mean, people are referring to him as our era's Thomas Edison. And I think in a lot of ways he is. And I'll get into exactly why, but I wanted to lead off the Steve Jobs thing in a couple of ways. First of all, I played that Jeff Goldblum thing at the top of the show, which cracks me up every time I hear it. Someone on YouTube, and God bless the YouTube people, they took that iMac commercial from, I don't know, what was it, 1996 or something, and slowed it down so that Jeff Goldblum sounds drunk, and he really does sound drunk. I mean, Jeff Goldblum has a weird manner of speaking anyway, but he sounds totally drunk when you actually slow him down. So, but it's funny also the things that were happening at the time in terms of technology and the iMac, where you could create your iMovies, and that was a big special thing at that time. But I mean, it was Steve Jobs who came back on board of Apple in 1995, 1996, and totally revolutionized, I think, the way personal computing is handled.
Absolutely true.
And here's the thing I really wanted to mention here at the top was that there was this great story in The Onion. And I don't often quote The Onion because I think it's easy to quote The Onion. But this was great.
Yeah, they're never not brilliant.
Exactly. So you kind of take them for granted. It's like, well, yeah, U2 is a great band, but I never really think about them until I actually hear them, because you take it for granted how great they are. But here's the headline from The Onion. Last American who knew what the fuck he was doing dies. And here's the story from Cupertino, California. Steve Jobs, the visionary co-founder of Apple Computers and the only American in the country who had any clue what the fuck he was doing, died Wednesday at the age of 56. Quote, "We haven't just lost a great innovator, leader, and businessman. We've literally lost the only person in this country who actually had his shit together and knew what the hell was going on," a statement from President Barack Obama read in part, adding that Jobs will be remembered for both for life-changing products he created and for the fact that he was able to sit down, think clearly, and execute his ideas, attributes he shared with no other U.S. citizen. This is a dark time for our country because reality is, this is a quote. This is a dark time for our country because the reality is none of the 300 million or so Americans who remain can actually get anything done or make things happen. Those days are over, unquote. Obama added that if anyone could fill the void left by Jobs, it would probably be himself, but said that at this point, he honestly doesn't have the slightest notion what he's doing anymore. So I thought that was great. And you know, I always lamented the fact that you couldn't just turn on a computer and be online and be able to do all the things that you want to do much in the same way that you turn on a television. Yeah, right. The experience of watching TV is as simple as turning the dial and flipping through the channels. That's how I always felt computing ought to be, at least at the consumer level. Certainly, if you're a programmer or if you use computers for editing, as you and I do, Chess, that's another thing entirely. But if you're just using computers to get information, to correspond with friends, it should be the easiest possible A to B process. Computers, especially Windows computers, and I'm saying this as I'm staring at my Windows computer, my desktop computer, that's not the case at all. And what Steve right. Jobs did was took that process and made it simple. I mean, and I just said I'm using a Windows computer right now, but I'm holding an iPhone. And I never realized how convenient and how revolutionary this guy was until I got my first iPod and was able to get all of my music onto a single small, like my iPod is about the size of an iPhone. And I've got my entire record collection. I mean, literally like 20 days worth of music.
I think a lot about the fact that I think back to, I used to have a Walkman, but it was, I would use it for like working out or that kind of thing. But I didn't really feel like I needed to walk around with it because I had always lived in places where, quite frankly, I drove. I had, cars with CD players or tape players or whatever. And then I moved to New York after 9/11. And New York is obviously a city where everybody listens to headphones. And at the time, all I had was my Walkman. And I would carry that damn thing with me everywhere. I always made sure, like I had a backpack, I had a coat that was big enough to stick my, whatever the thinnest Walkman I could find in there. And when I finally got an iPod and I saw what that thing could do and I could carry all my freaking music around and wander the city. I mean, I was honestly like, as somebody who loves music more than just about anything, I was honestly, where the hell has this thing been all my life? This right. is the greatest invention. This is the greatest invention ever in the history of mankind. That was one of those things where I'm like, I can't live without this. I cannot believe I lived as long as I did without this thing.
Yeah. And it's the same with the iPod. I mean, I got my first, the iPhone. I got my first iPhone almost a year ago today. In fact, it was almost exactly a year ago today. And I knew people who had them. I just was never really in a position to just, I had contract things with AT&T and blah, blah, blah. I didn't really want to get one until the time was right, and finally I said, I got to get one of these things. And even though I do have extensive computer experience, it was one of those things that it just became instantly usable. You could find what you needed. It was easy to download apps. It was easy to use. I mean, it's so utterly intuitive. It's so intuitive that you actually take it for granted how intuitive it is until you go back through and try to do something with your Windows PC. You don't realize right. how incredibly intuitive it is. And I have said, I have vowed every time I get a virus or a Trojan or some crazy thing happens with my, my desktop computers, I have two desktop computers, when they go, that's it for Microsoft. That's it for Windows. It's going to be all Apple from now on. And it's not just the computing experience. And this all speaks to the genius of Steve Jobs. Going into an Apple store, you want to buy those products. You want to support that company because as easy as the computers are to use, it's just as easy to go in and shop for something because, you know, you have a problem. They set up an appointment. You go back half an hour later. They take your thing. They bring it in the back. They work on it. They do something to it, and they hand it back to you. And if it doesn't happen that way, they give you another one. Right. I mean, it's the simplest process in the world, and that's the way it ought to be. I mean, you know, I wrote this on the blog. I can't imagine being a 70-year-old man. I can't imagine being my dad and getting into and buying a Windows PC, you know, like something that's running, whether it's Windows 7 or XP or Windows 8 or whatever it is, and being able to navigate their way around all of the danger that goes along with that. And that's even assuming they can get their email connected and get onto the internet. Mm. Once that happens, there's all kinds of software that comes bundled with it. There's trial things that come bundled with it. Do they accidentally click on that and sign up for a trial that they didn't want, or some sort of service they didn't want? How do they get rid of all this stuff that's on the computer, comes preloaded with it? How do they avoid getting Trojan horses? How do they install new software or even get it in the first place? How do they deal with all of the spam email that comes in and the scams, the phishing scams, the PayPal, all this crap that goes along with personal computing? It's literally, if you're not savvy with it, it's literally a minefield, because it could, right. In a lot of ways, if you make the wrong step, it could almost destroy your life. Maybe not in a fatal way. But, you know, there's identity theft and, you know, you end up wasting. I wish I had all the time I spent troubleshooting my computers over the years. I wish I had all that time back. I mean, literally, it'd probably be, I would say cumulatively, maybe up to, I would say a full year, but maybe just under a full year I've spent of my life beating my face against the wall, dealing with computers. I made an independent feature film 10 years ago. I lost the entire edit to that movie. And it was on a backup. I mean, both the main copy of it, of the edit, and the backup went bad. Both of them went bad. Windows. And, I've just lost all kinds of things, lost all kinds of time. And I think maybe because of that experience is one of the reasons why I really just appreciate Apple products, because they feel solid. It feels like, you know what, nothing could possibly go wrong short of me doing something stupid with my iPhone, like dropping it in a bucket of water or, you know,
well, I don't know chucking about it that, down the stairs. Obviously, you know, there is sort of built-in obsolescence with the sort of assembly line that comes out of came out of Jobs' imagination. You know, I mean, I think he once said, I can't remember, when exactly, but I'm pretty sure he once said, you know, the batteries and I know Apple said that batteries and iPods are only supposed to last like 2 years. So, you know, there was always built-in obsolescence, and that bugged me sometimes about, once again, built very, very well, but that always bugged me about Apple. And the only other thing, of course, just because it's worth making fun of, is, you know, the sort of Apple acolytes, you know, the Jobs disciples, who, you know, would honestly, if Steve Jobs pulled something out of the toilet that he made in the morning and held it up, in front of an audience with great fanfare and slapped an Apple logo on it, fucking people would just, you know, hipsters would be beating themselves up to get a hold of it. I was the first one who got the iTurd. I got it. Here I am. I stood out in line in the cold for, you know, 27 hours to get the iTurd.
The iTurd, right. Man, yeah, I know. If you want to, witness hipster culture firsthand, go to any Manhattan Apple store. And they're all there with their skinny jeans and their backpacks filled with Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Ironic t-shirts, tater tots.
Today's show brought to you by Bubble Genius at www.bubblegenius.com. It's the best damn soap in the world. Pure products, pure genius, Bubble Genius. And here now is their latest commercial. This is an important one. Listen up to this one.
We Bubble Geniuses like protests as much as the next liberal.
And as you know, we're not huge fans of corporate America.
We also like giving folks the wherewithal to kick those bastards in the ass whenever possible.
With that in mind, we made our own Occupy Wall Street picture soap.
Want to do your part to clean up Wall Street? Place an order with us and enter your discount code and get a free Occupy Wall Street soap with every order.
And if you'd like to do more to support these protests, you can load up on these babies and give them to all your friends.
For every Occupy soap you purchase, we'll donate half the profits to support those protesters who are out there making a difference.
Bubble Genius, helping America clean up its act, one dirty body at a time.
Go to our causes section for more info.
BubbleGenius.com.
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go. Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
That's right, iTunes. Support us in honor of Steve Jobs. Support the show on iTunes. Go to iTunes and subscribe to the show. It's absolutely free. And, speaking of bargains, you can get, there's a bargain, a deal going on at Bubble Genius right now. And I'm trying to find it here. Where is it? Oh, yeah. I'll put in the your promo code Bob and Chez, as always, BobandChez. Get 15% off your entire order, and you also get a free OWS, Occupy Wall Street soap.
The irony of Occupy Wall Street soap. There are so many good jokes there. Don't donate the money. Donate the soap. Come on, they're hippies. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Right.
I support that. I support that thing wholeheartedly. Seriously, good for them.
And I'm on board with it too. And I will confess though that I initially was quite skeptical about it.
And me too. I was sitting in the waiting room at the cancer center is when I finally got around, you know, because I had some time. Obviously, is when I got around to writing about, you know, my thoughts on it. And I think we agree on this pretty wholeheartedly, which is, yeah, you know, I kind of felt like, all right, sort of 60s model protest. That doesn't work these days. Okay, a bunch of you know, the critics who say it's a bunch of different causes and they can't seem to have one sort of solid message, can't seem to stay on message, which that's hugely important these days. That bugged me too. But, you know, I mean, it's come together and somebody's got to do something. And it's a really great starting point. So I'm not griping one bit. And if I were in New York, I would probably be out there right now.
Yeah, I always I've been wondering since the initial crash, you know, as a small business owner, I was feeling the effects of the recession even before the big crash. I mean, going back earlier in 2008, you could really see the signs of it. You could feel it happening in the economy. Everyone was tightening up. At that point, I was going, and especially after the crash, where the hell, where's the protest? Where's the anger on Wall Street? And I was there. I was walking around Wall Street. In fact, that whole financial district. Maybe it was last time I was there. At least downtown Manhattan was like late 2009, and you know, and I was right in the heart of the recession at that point. I mean, I was getting effed left and right by the recession in 2009. And walking with my brother and my brothers and my dad around Lower Manhattan. And we walked by that big brass bull statue.
The bull.
Yeah, the big bull there. And no, I mean, crickets chirping. It was a Saturday afternoon. No one down there except for, like, you know, as you go down there any day. Well, not recently, but normally you go down there and there's a bunch of people having photo ops with a big brass bull, you know, pretending to grab the bull because the bull has a giant unit. I don't know if you've seen this bull from 360 degrees of angle, but the bull has a huge set of nuts on him. And so the big joke is you go down there and you have a picture taken with your cup in the bull's nuts. So there's all people down there like fondling this brass bull's nuts and it's seemingly oblivious to the awfulness that occurred all around it. And it was frustrating to see this knowing that, you know, lives have been irreparably harmed to the tune of millions of lives, people losing their jobs, losing their houses, all kinds of awfulness, and just and crickets chirping downtown. You know, these guys just finding new ways, new forms of credit default swaps and hedge funds and all kinds of awful things to do that risk the economy, risk our livelihoods, but make them piles and piles of money. And so finally now we have a real movement down there. And you know, as you said, I mean, I was skeptical and just kind of, I initially just laughed it off. I said, well, here's another left-wing protest. A couple days down there. People are going to get together and they're going to bring their big giant paper mache puppets and their signs. We're going to have better spelled signs, I think.
Right.
But it's not going to last. It's not going to stick. But I think this one, I mean, it started on the 17th of September. We're now at the 6th of October, and it's getting stronger by the day. They have a list of demands. They have a purpose outlined. It's becoming stronger and better organized as time goes on. And thank you to the sons of bitches in the NYPD who have been kicking asses down there, because you know what? That's only helping the process. I mean, certainly no one wants to see anyone get hurt. But actually, you know, I have mixed emotions when I see something like that happening. On one hand, I'm outraged. I can't believe they're using this form of brutality. All these arrests and beatings and pepper sprayings. And then I go, well, you know what? That's actually the best thing in the world for the movement. It generates all kinds of sympathy for the protesters. It gives them an opportunity to put their grievances on the record. Because then, right. I mean, there's actual arrests that take place. That goes on the permanent record. That when historians of the future will look back, they know who was involved, because their names will be, on the criminal record as to who was arrested, who was detained, all of this, who was injured, for that matter, will be in hospital records. They will know what happened there in a very real sense. And so it's all very encouraging, and I hope that it does flourish. And I hope to see the kind of tenacity that we saw in the Middle East, quite frankly.
Well, I'm a little nervous about the cops. My dad's an ex-cop, so I've spent a lot of time. You know, I try really hard to give police the benefit of the doubt. I just do. It's, you know, maybe it's naive of me. Maybe it's just been ingrained in me by my father. I don't know. But, you know, it's interesting to me that the city of New York, that we have gone from, you know, in 10 years from seeing the NYPD as, these heroes to now they're basically beating down people in the streets. And I do think that they've overreacted by, you know, everything I've seen. Absolutely. You know, I don't know if I would call it technically brutality, but yeah, there's no denying that they're. I don't think that they are behaving in any way the way they should. And I also think one of the interesting things is, you know, a lot of the criticisms that you've heard about these protests, because of course they're, you know, the right. You can tell that things are going well because the sort of Fox News right wing talking points machine is starting to really go out of its way to discredit these people. But one of the interesting things I see is that one of the ways they try to discredit is the Fox News talking heads are always saying, well, you know what? What makes this different from the Tea Party is these people are breaking the law. They're breaking the law. They're breaking the law. But the interesting thing is I don't see them breaking the law. I really don't. I don't see anybody smashing anything. I don't see, you know, I see them behaving pretty rationally, actually. And what it actually says is the sort of double standard between right-wing protests and left-wing protests. I think it's just inherent that police don't like quote-unquote left-wing protests. I really do. And I think that that's something obviously that's existed for a very long time, certainly since the 60s. You know, a left-wing protest challenges by its very nature, even if it's behaving, is the reason it's existing. The reason the Occupy Wall Street movement is existing is to challenge authority. And obviously the police represent authority. And that's really the thing that pisses me off most about that is that if you think about it, these kids and, you know, everybody else who's down there, the people they're fighting for really are the cops. You know, I mean, it's the cops. It's, you know, it's cops. It's city workers. It's county employees. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's government workers. It's middle class people who have gotten fucked. And so the idea that somehow just as a sort of knee jerk, the cops are on the side of the people who are fucking them really kind of bothers me. Now, I know, you know, there's a lot of hay has been, you know, political hay has been made about the fact that a lot of these corporations, certainly a lot of the Wall Street giants, give money to the police departments, including the NYPD, to say, hey, you know what, here's a donation for you. Go do something good with it, which is basically, look, protect our asses, okay? Do your job. But the fact is they're still getting, you know, as middle class citizens, they're still getting screwed by these people.
Yeah.
And yet they, just as a matter of like I said, kind of like it's a natural knee-jerk reaction, they're not on the side of the kids down there.
Yeah.
They're not. There's just a natural antagonism between a left-wing Occupy Wall Street type movement and the police department. And it's really unfortunate.
A lot of comparisons get made to the Occupy Wall Street movement versus the Tea Party movement. And there are big differences. And some of these differences actually have resulted in the violence that we've seen. I mean, you know, you have the Tea Party movement, which, you know, I hate to generalize, but it's typically older conservative people. I mean, if you look at a Tea Party rally now, it's more like a lawn concert. A bunch of
cops are not going to beat up a bunch of, you know, septuagenarians in little hover rounds.
Right. And, you know, one of the first things I made fun of the Tea Party movement, there was this big revolution. It was supposed to be this huge thing. And they took the term Tea Party from the Boston Tea Party and applied it to their movement. Yet there they were, you know, on their official websites saying, make sure to get a permit for your protest. That's always cracked me up. Like, oh, you think the Sons of Liberty were getting permits to dump the tea into Boston Harbor? This is ridiculous.
And yeah, Stewart said that last night. He said, you basically, the namesake of your organization was possibly the most celebrated act of vandalism in this country's history.
Right, right. Yeah, I think we did a whole episode of this show talking about the different rules and regulations they had for the
yes.
Tea Party rallies. Like, no, you know, you can't stake your tent, you know, on the grounds. It's just like ridiculous. Like all these different rules and regulations, typical of what I think it would be a conservative protest. But, you know, and again, it's baked into the Tea Party pie that you're not going to have, you know, a lot of rowdiness. You're going to have a lot of contained anger and a lot of contained ugliness and horrible thoughts and ideas. But, you know, comparatively, if you have the Occupy Wall Street movement or any movement that's run by younger people and organized by younger people, there's more energy there. There's more anger there. There's, you know, even referencing back to what we were talking about earlier, there's a sense of immortality to younger people. And so therefore you have, you know, you have sort of these sort of immortality goggles on where you feel like you can take on the world. And
yeah. And yet what you don't have is some asshole with a gun strapped to his hip.
Yeah.
You know, basically insinuating violence against our leaders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I completely forgot about that, where people are showing up at the Tea Party rallies with guns.
With fucking guns.
And threatening gun violence. But from the comfort of their lawn chairs. So, I mean, so nothing happens to them. They're okay. They're allowed to go about their business and carry their handguns around in their stupid little holsters.
Right.
But, you know, these guys, you know, are these guys in lower Manhattan, elsewhere, pepper sprayed and arrested and beaten. I mean, you know, I hate to name drop like this, but, well, let's just say a friend who is in a very popular band that you and I both like, Jez, sent me an email and was just outraged about this video that he found on YouTube of, you know, this one police officer with a baton just kicking the living shit out of protesters, just beating them senseless, and eventually, like, attacking a journalist. And
you tell Mickey Thomas from Starship to stop writing.
Right. But yeah, I wish I could remember what the name of the video was. I'll have to look it up so you could actually go and see it.
There have been a couple. I mean, last night was the one where the, you know, the white, once again, the officer.
Yeah.
Officer, like the white-shirted higher up. was swinging his nightstick and, you know, trying to beat the crap out of people. And then, of course, there was the, you know, once again, I swear, try to give the NYPD especially a break, because I love New York, and I do respect the NYPD cops overall a lot. I respect cops in general. They got a tough job. It's not a job I want to do. So yeah, they automatically get my respect. But that fat bastard saying on camera, my nightstick's going to get a workout tonight, hopefully. I love how everybody who quoted that, by the way, left out the hopefully part. That to me was the worst part.
That's the worst part.
And he's like, you just see him. He's like, yeah, my nightstick's going to get a workout tonight, hopefully. And you just look at him and you're like, you know what? Put the nightstick away and you go get a fucking workout, fat ass.
Yeah. The video is of journalist Luke Rudkowski, R-U-D-K-O-W-S-K-I. You got your computer open, you go to YouTube, look up journalist Luke Rudkowski, and you can see him getting attacked downtown in Manhattan during the Occupy Wall Street protests. Unbelievable. Well, I try not to generalize, but you know, and I know a lot of those guys, they're just doing their job. And you can see, in fact, in this video, you can see that they're scared. You know, they're really
sure,
stuck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And cops do, you know, they are human. They feel like their lives are, you know, if they feel like there's a threat to them, they will, you know, I don't want to say strike back, but technically they're supposed to respond with, you know, appropriate force.
Yeah. But I mean, you end up with that guy, the guy in the video. And then, you know, I always go back to this, this one video I saw a couple of years ago, when there was one of these bicycle rallies where in Manhattan, and where everyone gets on their bike and it's almost like a flash mob where all of these bike riders show up. And you know, a lot of hipsters and assholes who show up on their bikes, and a lot of guys who like me, who just really like bike riding, all come together to, you know, to make a statement about bicycle lanes and so forth. And there's this video on YouTube of this one guy just minding his own business, riding down the street on his bike. And his NYPD officer just cold cocks him. I mean, just knocks him into the air. I mean, he flies off of his bike and lands several feet away on the pavement. And it's just, it's one of those things where you just go, God damn it. In an age of, I mean, put the basic decency and ethical behavior aside, in an age of everyone having a video camera built in.
Now that we live in the panopticon.
Everyone's got a camera on their phone, for God's sake. You just watch your step for – what an idiot.
You need to operate as if – and I mean this is the way cops – you know, in L.A., cops were wise enough to be thinking this, you know, 15, 20 years ago when there were choppers everywhere. It's like you have to pretend that you should – behave as if you're on camera at pretty much all times, because these days especially you probably are.
Yeah. And that even goes back. I mean, it's actually nothing entirely new. I mean, people have been videotaping shit like that. I mean, going back to Rodney King, you know,
now everybody carries a camera. Everybody's got one.
Yeah. And there's just, you know, there's just authoritarians out there who just like to throw their weight around and blow off steam in the wrong way. And I guess again going back to the original point of all of this is that let's try to look at the attacks in terms of the greater good. And I know it's hard to do that because it's really difficult to watch some of these things and to see it happening and seeing these crackdowns, people getting injured for the sake of doing something good. But I think ultimately that's what helps the movement. It's like if you look at the tenets of nonviolent protest, and even going back to the most common example, which is Gandhi. I mean, Gandhi actually liked it when he and his fellow protesters would be arrested or detained or beaten in some way, because again, that generated sympathy for the movement. So I think I think if we look at it in that sense, all of the right things are coming together. And, you know, I really believe that at some point it's going to reach critical mass. And I hope that Occupy Wall Street not only expands to other cities as it's been doing, but also expands to Capitol Hill. Because, I mean,
I think you're right.
As huge as the stuff happening around Scott Walker and the recall elections, as big as and important as that was, I always felt as though the real meat and potatoes of what's going wrong is focused on Capitol Hill. It's Congress's inability to really do anything serious about what's going on. And certainly a lot of the grievances of the Occupy Wall Street movement, including the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, has to happen on Capitol Hill.
I think you're right. I think it is definitely time for some sort of display, some sort of display at Washington. Yeah. That and eventually it's only a matter of time before they all descend. They prove Roger Ailes' worst paranoid nightmare, and they all descend on the Fox Studios on 6th Avenue. That's only a matter of time.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Those guys, Jon Stewart again did a great bit last night. Comparing the Fox News reaction to the Tea Party with the Fox News reaction to the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, and right. Even, you know, it's funny that a lot of these anti-government people are actually against the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's staggering to me how they are able to parse that.
Like, it doesn't. Don't even bother, really. Believe me, I do that all the time. And yeah. I'm just. The hypocrisy is so shameless and so baffling, and like you said, it just twists your mind into a pretzel. Mm-hmm. That it's almost. I know you say that we should get angry about it, and we should, but there are times that it is so overwhelming that, and I know you and I have talked about this, where you just get like, it's not just depressed, you're just like, fuck, there's nothing I can do about this. Yeah. How do you even reason with somebody who can think that way?
Yeah, and again, there is no, in a lot of ways, there is no reasoning. All there is, I mean, what it comes down to a lot of times is that the only thing that we can really do is to consistently prove them wrong, but also in the process to shame them into right. To the point where, you know, the shaming becomes contagious, and then everyone begins to not take them seriously. And again, this leads into something that was the other big news story of the last 24 hours, which is Sarah Palin not running for president. We'll get to that in just a second. Show is always brought to you by BubbleGenius.com. I swear to God, I mean, if you support Occupy Wall Street, part and parcel of that is not supporting businesses and corporations that are part of the problem. And one way you can do that is by supporting independent, progressive businesses. One of those businesses is a sponsor of this here show and has been for a long, long time, at least a year now. That is BubbleGenius.com. Bath and body products like you've never seen before. And more importantly, they support the Occupy Wall Street movement, and here's how.
We Bubble Geniuses like protests as much as the next liberal.
And as you know, we're not huge fans of corporate America.
We also like giving folks the wherewithal to kick those bastards in the ass whenever possible.
With that in mind, we made our own Occupy Wall Street picture soap.
Want to do your part to clean up Wall Street? Place an order with us and enter your discount code and get a free Occupy Wall Street soap with every order.
And if you'd like to do more to support these protests, you can load up on these babies and give them to all your friends.
For every Occupy soap you purchase, we'll donate half the profits to support those protesters who are out there making a difference.
Bubble Genius, helping America clean up its act, one dirty body at a time.
Go to our causes section for more info.
BubbleGenius.com.
The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
That's what it's called. Put in your promo code Bob and Chez, BOBANDCHEZ, and you also, in addition to getting 15% off your entire order, as usual, with your order, you will get a free Occupy Wall Street OWS. Make sure to use that hashtag on Twitter, too, by the way, OWS.
Right.
Get your free Occupy Wall Street soap, which will be handy if you're down there for an extended period of time and you haven't brought any cleaning supplies, you dirty hippie, you. So go and do that. Sarah Palin has decided not to run for president. I think this is what – this is partly a consequence of liberal tenacity with regards to Sarah Palin and exposing just her utter stupidity and lack of qualifications, the fact that she's completely out of her depth. I played this at the top of the show, and this is the classic Sarah Palin bit. This is where, you know, we kind of knew it leading up to the debates, and we were kind of weeding through, going back to 2008, weeding through all of the things that the McCain campaign did not vet about this person. And then we hit that vice presidential debate, and knowing how utterly out of her depth she was, couldn't even describe the role of the vice president. I mean, the job she was actually running for, couldn't describe what that job was, and then stepped into even worse the next day on Fox News Channel, and this is what came out.
One of the things you talked about last night was the flexibility that the vice presidency has.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
That thankfully our founders were wise enough to say we have this position and it's constitutional. Vice president will be able to be not only the position flexible, but it's going to be sort of those other duties as assigned by the president. It's a simple thing. I don't think that was a gaffe at all.
As the first serious word salad. I think that's what we got there.
I think that Sarah Palin killed Sarah Palin. I think that she's sort of been her own worst enemy, and that she flamed out at every single turn by making mistakes that were, I mean, obviously things like that, which are, you know, her people don't really give a shit about. But, you know, the big turning point, of course, I think was the Gabby Giffords shooting, when suddenly a lot of sort of Sarah Palin's everything that she was became intolerable, and her response to it was completely over the top. But I mean, Palin followed the trajectory instead of basically trying to create a real political career for herself. She followed the trajectory of a reality show star. You know, she did the modern celebrity Lindsay Lohan thing.
Yeah.
She was catapulted into the limelight. Pretty much accidentally, really, for no good reason. Once she got there, she hit hard. When she realized she had a following, she saturated the market. She made herself available for anything and everything. She made herself inescapable. She was in every form of media. There she was. And eventually what happens is, look, you know, you oversaturate the market and you create a backlash, and then eventually you vanish. And I think that, quite honestly, I think in spite of all the things that we said, I think that if there had been any meat to Palin, she would have lasted at least a little bit, no matter how many people didn't like her. But no, she just, you know, she flamed out, which is what celebrities like her do these days.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't have a flame out. And yeah, I mean, obviously, much of this has to do with her own behavior. But you can't have that kind of behavior and have it end up being so damaging to her reputation without people calling attention to it. And that's, sure. I think that's... that's ultimately my point here. I think, I mean, even though there was a movement which didn't really get widely publicized, but there was an agreement among the media at a certain point to just stop covering them, covering right. The Palins, because it was so obvious that they became just they were just feeding off of that media attention. And but even with that, you know, with that movement to completely ignore them, there was still an effort to call attention to all those things, like the Gabby Giffords thing,
I mean,
the Statue of Liberty.
The thing I wrote yesterday when she announced this, I'm like, you know, the desperate and sad scene that inevitably pops up, like, you know, like maybe an hour or so, half hour or so before closing at every club in America. You know, the one when like the tramp stamp drunk idiot girl at the bar starts making out with one of her girlfriends just to get people to pay attention to her. That's what yesterday was, and that's what this is. That's who Sarah Palin is. She is that poor, pathetic, drunk girl at a bar, desperate for somebody to watch her.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, and again, I don't want to pat myself on my own back or pat anyone on their own back for getting her to not run or for creating any sort of circumstances that would make it impossible for her to run. But I do think that there is. There continues to be an importance to dogging people like her, to just like it continuously and tenaciously calling attention to people. And it's just, sometimes it seems like a futile effort. It seems like, well, you know what, maybe we should just ignore them and they'll go away. Well, it's not the case. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, yeah, I mean, sometimes it works. Sometimes you just ignore and they end up disappearing or fading out. But I think Sarah Palin, I mean, I believe that what happened was is that with all of the attention given to her biggest gaffes, and to how inadequate she was as a politician, as a thinker, whatever the hell she ended up being, it grew beyond the bounds of progressive discussion.
Right.
You know, where it was beaten to death to the point that it bled into mainstream conversation. It even bled into conservative conversation, Republican planning. I mean, to the
That's
point
true.
Where Republicans decided that
they turned on her.
Yeah. I mean, they ultimately did. And I think it became it came around as a result of just this beating to death of these news stories.
I think what's interesting is I think that the sort of the last I'll never say the last nail in the coffin, because every good celebrity these days can figure out a way for a comeback. But I think that it's coincidental and kind of funny that, you know, the day that she announces that she makes this announcement, it's like sort of the last sort of, fuck you on your way out was the Ailes interview, where he said that basically she got her job at Fox because she was hot. She got ratings. That was just such a screw you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think what we're going to see now is just a continued disintegration of Sarah Palin. I mean, it's really historical in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't know if we've ever seen a politician rise and fall so vividly.
But once again, that's the reason for that is that she decided personally, she actually made this decision to not take the path of a serious politician,
yeah,
of a serious leader. She decided to take the path of really, I mean, a good example, sort of a good sort of analogy I can draw is she is to politics what sort of Lindsay Lohan or Paris Hilton was to celebrity, or to, Lindsay is a better example. Lindsay Lohan was to acting. Instead of, she probably had some talent. There was something there that could have probably morphed into something had she worked on it. But instead of taking the long and sort of hard road and pacing herself so that she could be taken seriously, she decided, you know what, screw it. I'm hot now, the hell with it. I'm going to strike while the iron's hot, and I'll put myself everywhere, and I'll pretend like there's never going to be a tomorrow. And eventually you wind up being right. Yeah. You know, you flame out quickly. You come and go very, very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. It was remarkable is that even the wing nuttiest of the wing nuts finally did determine and see her as the grifter she is. And I think that was a crucial piece of the puzzle, because without that support, I mean, you look at the latest polls, she's just like completely unpopular, even with her people. I mean, she's great and we think she's hot and everything. And boy, is she spunky. And she knows what we like, but she'll never be president.
Yeah.
And I think, you know what, I also think there's a chauvinism about that, too. And this is actually a little bit in defense of Sarah Palin. I think a lot of Republican males just had a big, big old hard-on for her. And
oh, my God, Rich Lowry wrote an entire piece about how we basically masturbated to her debate performance.
Oh, yeah. God. Well, that was the first big where he saw stars emanating from his TV and all that crap.
He may as well have just written, I just came.
Yeah. Well, that's just right. And you know, I think they kind of fell out of love with her. I think, I hate to say it, but I think they were objectifying her. And,
oh, I hate to say it. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, and that can only last for so long before they, kind of move on. And
to Essie Cuff, the younger version.
Yeah. And so I think they finally just said, yeah, you know what? Done with Sarah. They moved on. Which I don't think you ever see that. I mean, you wouldn't see that with, like, John McCain or some of the guys. I think chauvinism is kind of baked into the conservative way of thinking, and I don't think Sarah Palin was ever there because, you know, she was sharp as a tack on issues of foreign policy. I think she was there because, wow, she's easy on the eyes.
Well, Ailes just admitted it flat out.
We didn't get to Hank Williams. I want to talk about Hank Williams Jr. I wanted to mention, since when did they replace him with, like, some character from a Rob Zombie movie? Does he look like Captain Spaulding to you?
He's what's his name? Ned on Mind Quiz Box on South Park.
Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely, and we'll see you next week, Chess.
See ya.
Internet? I'd say internet.